Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
January 6th, 2021 is an experience that every person will remember where they were when they watched the siege of the U.S. Capitol unfold. For Dr. Bradley Onishi, the question that ran through his mind while watching the events was, would I have been there had I not left evangelicalism? It rang through his mind. In the months after January 6th, Onishi wrote the new book, Preparing for War, The Extremist History of White Christian Nationalism and What Comes Next, for release on January 3rd, 2023. The book weaves together Onishi's own life experiences and the history of the rise of the tide of white Christian nationalism in the United States to create an informative, emotive, and, to me, jarring depiction of the United States at this point in the country's history. You can find all of his work at bradonishi.com. Thank you so much for listening to our conversation. Dr. Bradley Onishi, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I mean, it's a true pleasure. And I know that's what people have to say on podcasts, but I just want to stop. And I know you want to say a bunch of stuff, but I need to say, This is a true honor to be here and what you've created on this show and what you've done as a podcaster, everybody should see as extraordinary because it's really a pretty amazing platform. And so thanks for having me.
I appreciate that. And I do want to start off with podcasting. I want to know about your podcast too, because, you know, I started doing my podcast in 2017 and did that for a long time. And then I saw other ones pop up like in the field of like religious studies. And I love it when they pop up because I have this philosophy about podcasting in this like niche field that we all do better when we all do better. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
And I love the like the camaraderie and the unity between the different podcasts with like within this field. And so I'm a big fan of Straight White American Jesus. And, you know, let's just start there. I want to know the origin story of Straight White American Jesus, because podcasting is just something that I love talking about. So tell me about this project and like everything that you want to share about it, because I want everybody to know about this show.
So 2018, working at Skidmore College. So near your kind of, you know, at least in your region there in New York.
Right.
And I had a friend over in Western Mass. And so we'd known each other for a long time going back to grad school days. Both of us were ex-evangelical ministers. So we have a long and deep history with evangelicalism and conservative Christianity. Now we're both religious studies professors. And just like everybody in the heart of the Trump years, trying to figure out ways to contribute, to help people understand, help people kind of find ways to maneuver through what felt like wreckage. And so we got together and said, look, let's just start a show. And I had it in my head. I was like, I want to call the show Straight White American Jesus, because I want to explain to people why so many Americans think that Jesus is a straight white guy who was born here, speaks English, you know, probably eats at Applebee's.
Surfer. And, he's a surfer.
You know, yeah, you know, just whatever it is. And why then Donald Trump and people like him are seen as kind of emanations of this American Jesus. And so we did that. We had no idea what we were doing. And we also just didn't know if anyone would listen. There's so many great people and great voices out there. But what we felt like we could bring to the table was an insider scholar kind of bifocal lens. We lived it. We can tell you, we speak fluent evangelical. Like you're not going to, you know, I don't have to conjugate evangelical verbs in my head. I have no accent. I have no, like I speak that better than anyone. And so does Dan, my co-host. We both went to seminary. We both studied theology. We both were ministers, but we also now study religion historically and sociologically and through political theory and social theory. So we can also kind of have conversations that really get into that. So, you know, just like you, we do it every week. We got 350 episodes now, and we're really, you know, where you have a kind of focus on just these amazing books in the humanities that pop up. We're really focused on Christian nationalism, the religious right, and generally religion and politics in the United States.
Amazing. Okay, so let's go back to that origin story then of finding yourself in the evangelical Christian world, because where you have wound up compared to where you began, like that, the stories of that in the book are so compelling, and you're just such a personable speaker. So I kind of want to hear the story from your own mouth while I got you.
Sure. Thanks for asking that, Greg. So I'm 14 and I'm in a non-religious home. My dad's a Japanese American guy from Maui. My mom's a white woman from Missouri. Both moms nominally Christian, dad's nominally Buddhist, kind of decided to leave religion out of the marriage, I guess, in order to try to have a happy home. Didn't work. They got divorced anyway. And so at 14, I'm like a punk kid getting in trouble. I'm getting suspended from school, sex, drugs, rock and roll kind of stuff. And my then girlfriend invites me to the youth group at church. And it's, you know, look, it's Wednesday night. There was no other way I was going to convince mom to let me see my girlfriend on a Wednesday night when I was 14. So if she invites you to church and you're like, mom, I'm going to go to a Bible study. I think, you know, we should give Jesus a chance. I think I need him in my life. Mom's not going to say no. So she, of course, is like, I'll take you right now. Let's go. And get there. And instead of like boring Ned Flanders guys who are, you know, Heidi Ho neighbor, it's cool young leader dudes with tattoos and guitars, and they play in Christian punk bands, and they want to, like, you know, talk to me about surfing. And I'm like, whoa, this is pretty cool. And then I learn about Jesus and the forgiveness of sins and heaven. And I was a really angsty kid, you know, kind of portending a professorial life. And I just was always wondering about the meaning of life. So anyway, long story short, very quickly, the girlfriend dumped me, but I kept going. I mean, I became the kid that went to church anytime it was open, whether that was youth group, Bible study, Sundays, retreats, boys, you know, summer camp, you know, whatever was up. By the time I'm 18, I'm in ministry. By the time I'm 20, I'm married and I'm a full-time minister at the mega church and in charge of 200 kids. So that's, you know, I couldn't even buy a beer at that point, but it was doing all that.
Wow. Okay. So, first of all, who are your favorite Christian punk bands from back in the day?
So I was right there for the MXPX Renaissance. Yeah. I mean, so those guys were everywhere. And then I'm from Southern California. So we had a lot of Five Iron Frenzy. Yep. Shout out to them if they're listening. And a lot of OC Supertones, the ska band. You know, there's a lot of ska around it's very embarrassing now. There was later on, there was like POD, there was Stave Saker.
Yeah.
There was Third Day. I was gonna say Green Day, which is obviously not a Christian band. So anyway, those are the ones that really, like, those were our jam. Sixpence None the Richer was in there. Anyway.
Nice. Did you listen to The Undecided from Winnipeg, Manitoba?
I remember them. Yep.
Loved The Undecided. And so there were so many. I love it. So anyway, what denomination did you kind of like find yourself in? Can you like define the basics of like what it is that you found yourself in and kind of tell the audience like what the exact scenario and context of your practice was at that time?
So this is going to be a wild ride, everybody. So buckle up.
Yes.
So I come from North Orange County. So kind of on the border of LA County going into what y'all imagine is like the real OC. And so my town is the town where Richard Nixon was born. Mm-hmm. And in a very strange turn of events, that part of Southern California is full of Quakers, full of you know, Society of Friends people. So there's two churches in the town I grew up in, and it's not a big town, that are Quaker and have at least at one time had over 2,000 people. Now, what happened in that those churches, though, is you take all that cool stuff about being Quaker, egalitarianism, silence, a commitment to social justice, abolitionism, you know, no hierarchy, no patriarchy. And you run all that through the kind of generic evangelical cheese grater. And at the end, you get something that looks like a wannabe Rick Warren church. And so we were a name Quaker. But, you know, one of the things that happened to me when I got to seminary is like I started to look around and think all the cool stuff that is, you know, inherited from the Society of Friends, we don't do any of it. It just seems like we want to just be wannabe mega church people. And that's part of what kind of unraveled everything for me. So, so that's the basic outline.
And you were super intense in like school and in public. And like, you were like, kind of like one of those people that's kind of like, you know, if a video would pop up today of like people like saying things like on a plane or outside of like, you know, sporting events, like that would be you, right?
I'm the oldest brother of three, and I kind of just do everything so hard and so extreme that I ruin it. And so that definitely happened with being a Christian. When I was 13 and 14, I used to ask my mom to take us, my friends and I, to the movies. And then we wouldn't go to the movies. We'd go around the back and do stupid teenage stuff. But when I converted, I would still go to the movies, but instead of going into the movies or going behind the movie theater to do teenage stuff, I would stand in front of the movie theater. And when people my age came out, I would ask them if they had met Jesus and if they knew they were going to spend their eternity. At school, I led a Bible study. So I would sit on a planter at school and host a Bible study, and some people would come. I'd walk around with tracks at school, the beach boardwalk, any of those places. Some people might remember See You at the Poll. It's a once a year event where teenagers gather to pray for the country and this kind of stuff. And they do that at their school flagpole.
Yeah.
That wasn't good enough for me just because I ruin everything. And so I was like, I'm going to do See You at the Poll every Friday, and I'll invite people. And usually it was just me. So I'd just go stand out there on a Friday at my public school and pray, and people would walk by me like, what's this guy doing? And there you go.
It's amazing that you brought that up, because I was literally reading that portion of the chapter like 30 minutes ago. I love it. So what was so you were obviously extremely committed, extremely devoted, very much into bringing other people into the fold. Why did you stop? Tell me about your journey out.
You know, I think it's in some ways a very common story of people who are now ex-evangelicals, ex-LDS, ex-Catholics, in the sense that what you'll hear from certain church people is, oh, you never cared in the first place. You were never saved in the first place. And what a lot of us respond with is, look, I'm not the never were. I'm not the one who was never in. I'm the done. Like, I gave everything I had, including my brain. And when my brain kicked in college and then in seminary, and I started learning theology and history and philosophy, I started to think through all the things that seemed important to us, whether that was abortion, whether that was, you know, not having sex before marriage, whether that was why I had to vote Republican, no matter what, commitments to war. I mean, you know, Greg, we're a Quaker church.
Mm-hmm.
I go to a prayer meeting every Tuesday. And I can tell you that every Tuesday we were asked by the, you know, people in the congregation to pray for the military, pray for the police.
Yeah.
And we never once in 7 years prayed for peace. And, you know, after a while you start, you know, you read enough books and you do enough thinking and you're like, this is weird. And then you start tracing your history and you start doing your lessons in American politics and all kinds of stuff, biblical studies. And, you know, they say you're if you let your head, you know, get too strong, and it'll lead your heart away from God. And I'm not sure that happened, but it certainly led me away from the American evangelicalism that I was brought into, because it just became no longer tenable for me.
Yeah. And you got out of the country. They went to the UK.
I went to Oxford, which I had no business being at, and I can go into an hour long explanation as to why I had no business being there getting a master's degree, but I was. And you know, in some ways that was really hard, because I moved there in 2005 straight from ministry. So I had never had another job as an adult. After high school, other than being a minister, I had been married by that time for 4.5 years.
Yeah.
And I had never left the country. So here I am in a 1,000-year-old city at a 1,000-year-old university where John Locke and Duns Scotus went. And, you know, away from home, anonymous, there's no church ladies at the grocery store kind of watching me. There's no youth group parents wanting to shake my hand when I go to the, you know, the baseball field. And very quickly, my wife and I decided to get divorced. It was just, you know, we'd been together since we were 14, and it was just not you're different when you're 24 than 14. And very soon I was like, I'm not sure I want to do this anymore when it came to church. And so my life changed dramatically, to say the least.
Wow. Amazing. Okay. So then you go on to a career as a professor. But then we shoot forward, we careen into the future, to the present day, and you have a brand new book coming out. Seriously, one of the most interesting books that I've come across in some time. Like, I'm loving this book so much. The book is called Preparing for War, and it opens on January 6th, 2022. And, you know, something about this opening capture my attention, because you talk about feeling buoyant during the transition months after Joe Biden wins the election over Donald Trump in 2020. But I felt the complete opposite. I felt horrible the entire transition, because I felt something was going to happen, and it absolutely did. And so tell me about your experience on January 6th, 2021, and your processing of these events, because you saw it in a way that a lot of people can't.
Yeah. You know, so if people remember, that was, you know, you woke up on January 6th and Warnock and Ossoff had won their Senate seats in Georgia, right? So you wake up and you're like, whoa, the Senate is blue by the slimmest of margins. The House is blue. Biden's going to take office. There's a chance here that this country can find a way to undo the regressive actions of the previous administration. So that morning I wake up, I go surfing. It's like freezing, at least for my standards. It's like 39 degrees when I get out of the car. The water's like, you know, I know, feel free to laugh at me.
Yeah.
It's like 47 degrees in the water, but I'm just like so happy, because I'm in the water just thinking, wow, like things could really change in some minor positive way. I get out of the water, I take a selfie. There's like a, you know, it's like golden hour.
Dude, sunrise. I saw that picture. I remember the picture.
It's just like, you know, and I look back at it now and I'm like kind of smiling and happy. And the whole way home, I'm like, oh, wow. And then as soon as I get home, you know, you open the computer and here we are. And I'm watching it. And, you know, once I get over the initial shock, you start to notice all the Christian symbols. And very quickly, Peter Manceau, the American,
he's amazing,
curator, yeah, great guy, you know, is using hashtag capital C's religion. And he's doing so to chronicle all the ways that, you know, Christian and other symbols are showing up. And you start to kind of realize that this was a religious crusade in many, many ways. And then for me, my brain kicks in and is like, maybe I would have been there. Like,
oh, man,
if I don't leave, and am I going to be there? And I found out later there were people from my hometown who were there, from my church. And there you go.
Wow. Okay. So we all remember these days. Everybody who in the country was paying attention to that saw it and experienced it in their own ways. And they've continued to process it in like the almost 2 years since then. Tell me about the formulation of how this book comes together, preparing for how you process with the events of January 6th. And like weave it into your own personal story. Tell me how you begin to process this story in order to start to like bring this book, Preparing for War, together.
You know, I really wanted to do two things. So there are so many books out there about how and why Trump won the evangelical vote, how and why conservative Christians, whether they be Catholic or Protestant or LDS or others, have really become extremist when it comes to their politics over the last 5 years or 10 years, et cetera. A lot of those are done by amazing journalists who haven't really lived it, but are in the weeds, reporting, finding sources, right? And many of them are my friends and colleagues, you know, Catherine Stewart's book, The Power Worshippers, and Nelson's book, Shadow Network, Sarah Posner's book, Unholy, and so many others. There's another genre out there, which is the kind of ex-evangelical, ex-Catholic, ex-Mormon memoir that really helps people kind of see like what it was like to live something like this tradition. Mm-hmm. I wanted to provide one that brought those two together and say, look, here's how I lived as an evangelical, and here's how I was trained to think of us as in a war, a spiritual battle for the country, and to also think that the country was headed towards an apocalyptic cliff if we didn't save it. And so what I do is I use my own experiences and I kind of integrate those into what I think of as a 60-year process of preparing for war. And so I begin in the 1960s, could have started earlier, could have started way earlier. I know that. But the 60s to me represent a kind of counter-revolution where white Christians, patriarchal, native-born, the whole thing, start to look around and think, all right, there's a feminist movement, there's a queer liberation movement, there's certainly a civil rights movement, there's immigration reform, Loving Act passed, interracial marriages ago. We're losing our country. That was their response.
Right.
And so that kicks in a generations long war to take back the country any way possible. And one of the conclusions I come to in one of the later chapters is, if that means martyring democracy, if democracy has to go in order to save the country for themselves, they'll do that. And they and I can show you the receipts, and I can also show you how I was taught to think that way in my own experience.
That chapter you're referring to, Killing Democracy to Save the Nation, incredible, incredible chapter. I am loving that as well. Let's do a little bit of terminology, if that's okay with you. I want to know about the terms evangelical and nationalist, so that we can then bring together Christian nationalists. So I want to hear about these terms, kind of weave these together, because just because somebody's a nationalist doesn't mean they're an evangelical. Just because somebody's an evangelical doesn't mean they're, you know, a nationalist. Does that make sense? So I want to hear about these differentiations and then tie it together with Christian nationalist.
Yeah, no. So I think evangelical is a notoriously slippery term. If we have scholars of evangelicalism or fundamentalism or the history of Christianity, they're all going to have their own definitions and their own emphasis. So just start with that. But in my mind, I think if we're just going to give a basic approach, evangelicals are people who will tell you they take the Bible seriously. You're going to see places like Rochester Bible Church or Family Bible Church of Anaheim. And that's because they really think that the Bible is either the inerrant or infallible word of God, that it's to be read as closely as you can to literally, and to be understood as basically dropped from heaven and to be obeyed. So that's number one. Number two, they have a sense in which apocalypse is really in a kind of important aspect of their thinking. And again, various and multidimensional. So
sure.
I'm sure that I'll get some emails and say I missed this or didn't talk about that. But in my experience, the end of the world was overlaid onto everything. Politics, culture, elections, the VMA, MTV Awards, all the way to the war in Iraq was about, if we don't do something, the country will go away. And the world is getting more and more evil because that people are falling away from God. There's an emphasis too, and I think that this comes up in today's world in ways that people should really understand, that religion is an individual endeavor. It's something that you have between yourself and God. And it can be taken to such an extreme degree that one can be a Christian or an evangelical and not really even attend church, because mm-hmm. things are so individualized that if you have a personal relationship with Jesus and you you know, are assured of that and can talk the talk in that way, in a manner that might really confuse some folks who aren't familiar with this, right? The kind of daily or weekly practices of religiosity are not necessarily the proofs of your faith. And so they're, if I just give a very basic definition of an evangelical, they're individual, they're Bible-centered, and they're usually apocalyptic. And then I think one more thing that's really important here is they have a very kind of energetic certainty. And I know that sounds strange. What I mean by that is, if you have that interpretation of the Bible and you think that the world is going to end, then there is no room for for being tepid. You know, when I was growing up, the idea that you would kind of be a Catholic and go to mass once a week and, you know, kind of do it that way made no sense to us. The idea that you would be, you know, a kind of religious person who went through the motions didn't make any sense in our mind, because it was all or nothing. It was everything is at stake all the time. And I think that really helps people perhaps comprehend why the politics can ramp up and get so extreme so quickly. If you're living in that kind of world, that world that says, I know the truth, I know the right way, I know what has to happen, and I'm committed to it, because if I don't, everything is going to go terribly and everything is at stake and everything that I care about will go away. You can see how we get to where we got throughout the Trump years, the Tea Party, and all that stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So bring in nationalists now. What is that term? And then how do we get to Christian nationalist?
So a nationalist, in very broad terms, is somebody who believes that their, you know, their country or their nation demands their loyalty and their service, and they believe that their allegiance and their priority should be to that nation. And so, if I'm an American nationalist, what I'm telling you is look, I recognize that there are human beings in Pakistan and in France and in Thailand. I recognize that human beings exist all over the world. But my nation has a certain character. It has a certain set of virtues. It has a certain history. And as a people, that is my priority. The freedom, the identity, and the autonomy of my country, of my nation, is what I see as the priority of my life and my allegiance. And so as a nationalist, anyone or anything or any state that encroaches on the identity, freedom, or autonomy of my nation is going to be seen, in my eyes, as an enemy and as something that should go away. Now, as a nationalist, it doesn't mean that I want to destroy all the other nations. It means I just think all the nations should take care of themselves, and they all have their self-interests, and they all have their vested kind of priorities. They all have their ways of life. Okay, great. Just leave me alone. And if you get in my way, or you bump my shoulder, you step on my foot, then we'll have an issue. But otherwise, I'm going to tend to my nation. You go tend to yours. You can kind of see, though, how this starts to trickle out, right? If I start to think this way, then I start to have the kind of language to say that those other nations do it that way. Well, those people over there do it right in that manner. Too many of those folks in our space, right? You can start to see how this turns into, right, other strains of xenophobia or you know, other things that we can get into later. But anyway, yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. So, you know, what I want to know is, like, how do researchers identify a Christian nationalist? Because, like, if you go up to somebody and you say, hey, what are you? They're not going to be like, hi, I'm John, I'm a Christian nationalist. Like, how do you, like, identify how many of, like, people are like this and fit this certain characteristics? Like, how do you find these people?
So I think, you know, what I've tried to do in my work is take both cues from sociologists and then also cues from history. So I think that, you know, Perry and Whitehead in their book, Taking America Back for God, do us a great service for a number of reasons. One is they show through data the ways that Christian nationalism corresponds to certain positions when it comes to immigration, when it comes to war, when it comes to increasing diversity in the United States, when it comes to gender. But what they do that really sticks out to me is they put Christian nationalism on a spectrum. And so in my view, if you say that this country was a country built for and by Christians, you are a Christian nationalist.
Okay.
Now that can fall on a spectrum. That could mean, yep, you know, I'm Betsy from Kansas City. I think the Puritans built the country. I think Christian people should be proud of that. And I think the country was built that way. And I'm still more comfortable if we got a Christian president. I'm still more comfortable if my local representative is a Bible believing, you know, Presbyterian. That makes me feel good. And yeah, I kind of think that there's no problem if we say the Pledge of Allegiance and one nation under God and our money says in God we trust. You know, those are good things. They're part of our heritage. Why would we get rid of that? Yeah, you know, you're over there. You want to be Buddhist. You're not bothering me. Look, I'm not coming out here trying to you know, persecute you, but I'm just kind of, you know, more or less into this idea of a Christian nation. Now that can turn into all the way in the other end of the spectrum, some instantiations that we're seeing now in various publications and various, you know, various expressions, which says you should institutionalize your Christianity to the point that the Christian has, that the nation has a set of Christian laws, a set of Christian policies, and a set of Christian leaders, and we should accept nothing less. That if there is a non-Christian in the White House, if there is a majority of non-Christians in the country, if there is a situation where people are no longer recognizing that this is a Christian nation by founding and by character and by virtue, then we need to fix that. And that can happen through elections. It could also not. It could also happen just by dint of force and by dint of us taking back the country any way possible. And we're seeing that kind of expression now. So I think sociologically that spectrum really helps me. Okay. And then I think historically what we see is that a Christian nationalist is often defined, and this is where the white comes in, because this is something that I think is true of white folks who are Christian nationalists, is they often have a sense that the country used to be better. And this is why I started in the 1960s, because they think that, you know, the 1960s led to chaos. Like when they see women's rights, queer liberation, civil rights movement, interracial marriage, women entering the workforce, no excuse divorce, no fault divorce, you know, Immigration Act bringing in people from Korea and from Ethiopia, they don't see progress and more representation and equal protection under the law for the trans person, for the gay couple, for the interracial couple. What they see is, you know, it used to be peaceful and now it's not. And everything's confusing. Everything, there's more than two choices. It's not just good or bad, right or wrong. Now it's pronouns and various identities and you're part Filipino and part Mexican. And it used to be better. It used to be simple. And I want to go back to that. And I feel like that's what we need. So that nostalgia is a huge driver of Christian nationalism in many pockets.
You know, and we have that undercurrent for decades, okay? 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, but then we get to 2021, January 2021, and then the big lie comes in. And I want to know for you how crucial that big lie is. So say Trump came out the day after the election, is like, oh, I lost, everything's over. Things would, you know, move into a normal transition, but then we have the big lie, which opens a window of opportunity. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
The way I think about the big lie is as perhaps the most vicious and the most consequential conspiracy that we've had over the last, you know, 50, 60 years in this country. It follows along birtherism. It follows along everything. Whether it's a John Birch Society, Satanic Panic, there's a litany of these. But here's how I would characterize it. You know, we talk about white privilege often, and people, I think, have started to get their heads around that over the last couple of years. And if I say white Christian privilege, one of the things that I think about is white Christians in this country, not only often, not all Christians and not all people, but they often think of themselves as having a kind of privilege when it comes to representation. We have 45 presidents. We are 46th now in office. They've all been Christian. There's 88% of our Congress is Christian in some way. And so there's this sense in which that it kind of goes unsaid that if I'm a Christian in this country, I'm going to sort of just have a benefit of the doubt. We're going to pray before the football game to my God. My Pledge of Allegiance says under God in a way that honors my monotheism. But let me stretch it a little bit. What is more privileged than getting to decide what is real and true and actual? Mm. If I just show up in the public square and I say, I hear all your voices, all of you newcomers from other countries, all of you mixed race people, all of you queer folks, and guess what? I'm the one who has the right to determine in this public square what is real, what is true, and what is actual. And you're going to abide by that, whether you like it or not.
Mm.
That is the ultimate privilege. And that is the big lie. It says, there's no evidence that you can show me that will convince me otherwise, because I feel this. I feel it in my heart. I feel it in my soul. And therefore, it must be true. And because of who I am, I have the privilege to do that. And everyone else better get in line, or I will show up at the Capitol and I'll tear it down if I need to.
Oh, man. And this is stressing me out, too, because we are on the verge of an election in a week and a half. And then another one in two years. And, you know, there's a section in your book, page 23, it says the script reads like this: we have a short time to save the country if we don't treat this as a red alert situation and devote all our time and energy to this campaign. The country will be destroyed by Marxists and socialists. And then you write, political opponents become demons. And so every single election now is this total collective national trauma that, you know, our election cycles go on for 14, 15, 18 months. So it's just this drug out permanent, like, trauma. It's abuse. And so here we are on the precipice of a new election. And I dare I ask your sentiments in the forecast of the future, like, because I know the book does some forecasting. I'm like wondering, how are you feeling about this after having immersed yourself so much in these topics while writing this book? How are you feeling about the future? Because for me, I'm having a hard time.
Yeah, I totally understand why you would. And so in the passage you talked about, I'm trying to explain how, you know, Christian nationalists think. They really think that, you know, if we don't save the country, the quote unquote Marxists and socialists and godless heathens will take over. And one of the things that I recently learned and talked about with my colleague Lucas Kwong, who's making a spinoff series for us at Straight White American Jesus called Monster in the Mirror. You know, he's looking at monsters from the 19th century, Dracula and War of the Worlds. And he's basically saying that the 19th century Britain was worried about their crumbling white Christian empire. And so they invented monsters to blame it all on. And it kind of sounds familiar, right, everybody? All right,
wow.
here's your podcast series, right? So, you know, the podcast series is really cool. But one of the things he said to me is like, look, if you turn your political opponent into a monster, you not only can't, but you shouldn't respect them, listen to them, dialogue with them, compromise with them. But if you are dealing with a monster, the idea that you would put your hand out and say, can we talk about this, is the last thing you would ever imagine to do. So if you turn Hillary Clinton, as Alex Jones did, into an actual demon and say she smells like sulfur, if you say that people who are part of the cabal of Illuminati are serpents and have serpent DNA, if you think of people from Asia as a horde and having, you know, this tendencies to feed off of the flesh of others, whatever may be, there's no sense in respecting or talking or listening or dialoguing or compromising. It's all just destroy the monster. So I think that helps us understand what one side of the country is thinking. And what that forces the other side into is to say, you think I'm a monster. So when I try to put my hand out and compromise, talk, dialogue, have some kind of good faith, I run into Marjorie Taylor Greene or Lauren Boebert screaming nonsense about, you know, demons and lasers and everything else under the sun. And it's like, what this forces me into is I have to look at these elections as make or break, because you're willing to burn the house down like you literally almost did on the 6th. In order to get what you want here. So all that to say, what am I for? You know, I think anything could happen in these midterms. And I'm not going to be somebody who makes some prediction and acts like he knows stuff. I think if you run into that person in 2022, you should consider them sophomoric and dangerous, because we don't know. What I do think will happen is, these are just very general themes about things, is no matter who wins and who loses, when you see a GOP candidate not be victorious, the claims of election fraud will just be ever present. They are now a standard part of our culture politically, and that is really, really dangerous. If we get Carrie Lake in Arizona or Doug Mastriano in Pennsylvania, a couple of other races, we have a situation where we have governors who may not be willing to certify a Democratic winner in their state when it comes to 2024, right? When it comes to the House, if the Republicans win and they have a majority, I think they're very serious about just saying, we'll let the good credit of this country go. We won't raise the debt limit, because you know what? Y'all are demons. And I mean, think about that mindset. If I'm staring down the face of a dragon and it's like, hey, your credit score might go down. And you're like, who the hell cares? I got to get rid of the demon. I got to get rid of the dragon. Right. So, yeah, screw it. I'm not going to raise the debt limit. I'm not going to talk to these Democrats over here. Do I think that's justified in calling the Democrats a demon? By no means. But that's where the Republican Party is now. I mean, it's not the fringe part. It's the absolute power holders and stakeholders in that party. And that is where we're at. So I'm not going to make any prognostications about any races or anything else, but those are the things I'm watching thematically.
And that ties into the book. You have a chapter called Extremism is a Virtue. So this is like a feature now, not a bug. It's not an accident. It is an extraordinarily specific set of choices that you mention, of like being a part of halting the expansion of civil rights and preventing mainstreaming of religious, racial, sexual, and ethnic minority rights, so it's cultural history and very political, and it's all about grabbing power. Oh, it's so bleak. I don't even have a question now. I'm just like,
well, and you know, extremism as a virtue is a 1964 quote from Barry Goldwater, who said that when he won the GOP nomination for president and was speaking in San Francisco of all places. So I guess that's my point, right? Is like, this has been building since then. You know what I mean? It's not just Trump. It's not just McCarthy. It's not just Mitch McConnell. It's been building since then. The idea that if you're an extremist, that's good. If you're a moderate, that's bad.
Right. Well, you know, what's really interesting about this too, I think about this a lot, about how I have extraordinary qualms with so many of the decisions and policies of the Democratic Party. And I will openly, happily critique them so often. And that the major difference is that the other side seems often completely incapable of critiquing minor things. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm totally happy to critique like the people that I tend to agree with more. I will critique everyone equally as much as I possibly can, but one side seems completely incapable of critiquing their own side. And that scares me a lot.
So Liz Cheney's the best example, right?
Yeah.
So Liz Cheney did not change her position on voting rights, on immigration, on government spending, on healthcare. None of that. Just changed her position on one thing. After J6, she's no longer with Trump. And guess what happened to her? She's out of the Republican Party, essentially. I mean, they censored her in her own state. And so to me, that speaks to your point, is that if you have a party where loyalty to a figure, not policy, not position, is the way to gain entrance or exit, you're really far down the road towards something that in the 30s or the 40s or other times we would have called fascism, totalitarianism, authoritarianism. I mean, we can do all the definitions and I'll have all the discussions, and I know the scholars out there have all the examples that they would prefer to use. I'm just saying, the point for me is, if the only way to get in or out of the party is to show loyalty to the leader, you're in a bad way.
Yeah. You know, and you mentioned the possibility that there could become governors in this country that don't certify elections when it comes to the other party being legitimately victorious. And we have a lot of other things that I see being tied to this as well, especially like relation to killing democracy, such as the way that we gerrymander voting districts, disenfranchise numerous groups, and the way that the legislative branch didn't even convict the former president during the second impeachment, ban him from running for office again. And like, are there any other like anti-democracy forces at work here that I am overlooking with regards to Christian nationalism and the book in general?
I think there's a lot. I think there's so many. So I think one of the things that we've highlighted in our show and that people should really be aware of is the independent state legislature theory. And so it's the idea that the state legislature is the ultimate decider of the electoral votes for any one state. So let's just take Arizona. Under this theory, the Arizonans, the people of Arizona, could vote in the 2024 presidential election and say 60% Democrat, 40% Republican. And so that goes to Biden or whoever is the Democratic nominee. So he gets the electoral votes. She gets the electoral votes for Arizona. Well, the independent state legislature theory says, well, hold on. It's actually the state legislatures who have the final say. And if they think that there's a reason not to certify those results and those electoral votes, and that they should go to the other person because of voting irregularities, because of issues with procedure, because of whatever, then they are able to send their electoral votes for Arizona to whoever they feel like. And they're not even beholden to the state Supreme Court. So even if they decide to do that and the Arizona State Supreme Court gets an appeal and they're like, hold on there. That's not happening. Under this theory, the Supreme Court of that state has no jurisdiction. This is gaining traction. And the Supreme Court is actually next term going to hear this. And so try a case on this. So all that to say, that would make it almost near impossible to have a democracy if a set of state legislatures could decide who became president. There's more examples, but that one sticks out to me.
This is an extraordinarily important period in history, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, I know we could say that about every, you know, I think history is full of extraordinarily important moments and depends on who you're asking that of, right?
Sure.
I think what's really extraordinary about right now is that the decisions and the events seem to apply to everyone in the country. You know what I mean? So we could talk about the 60s or 70s or 80s, and those were extraordinary times for so many Americans, but there's so many Americans for whom they weren't, and their lives felt like they were pretty static. Right now, it feels as if this reaches to every corner and every nook and every cranny of the American populace. And I think that's why we're in such a place. Now, I think it's extraordinary too. There's just another reason, is that there's a very real chance, and I'm not trying to be hyperbolic here, that American democracy slips into what is not really a democracy. And I think that is why this all feels so anxiety producing at all times.
Well, Brad, what is next for you? You know, I know the book release is coming up. What are your plans to continue informing and working with the public on making everybody aware of these kinds of things? What do you got in the pipeline?
Well, you know, for me, week in and week out, the goal is to say, how can we shine a spotlight on these things so that more and more people understand the situation we're in and why? And if we can do that, perhaps we can be on a train that helps persuade and activate people to realize what is at stake. In elections, what's at stake in our culture, what's at stake in general. So I think that's really number one that's always on my mind. That's why I do what I do. That's why I get up in the morning. That's why I get up in the morning for a lot of reasons, but that's one. And that's why I wrote this book. I think on the other hand, there's a plan for us to really expand what we're doing at Straight Out White American Jesus into a number of various podcast spinoffs that look at things from a different angle, and provide people content that they can use in various ways, including educationally and pedagogically. So I mentioned Monster in the Mirror. So Lucas Kwong's creating this great series, and he's basically providing you, if you teach literature, if you teach English literature, if you teach Victorian literature, he's giving you 6 hours of content that is academically informed by an expert, but it's filled with dramatic readings by voice actors, sound effects.
Love this.
Original music. And you get all the Dracula, all the War of the Worlds, all of the monsters of the 19th century. But then he does this thing where he's like, hey, you know, when so-and-so talks about blood-sucking cabals of elites, and they do so through George Soros, it sounds like anti-Semitism in the United States, right? It also sounds like Dracula. And he, all of a sudden, you're brought forward and you're like, holy moly. To me, that's something you can assign. You can put that on your syllabus if you're teaching 12th grade or intro to lit or a Victorian seminar in college. And to me, that's pretty exciting, right? Because like, if you're a student, wow, voice actor, sound design, I can transcript, I can read it if I need to, we can talk about it in class. That's pretty cool. So that's kind of on the horizon for us.
Amazing. Well, the book Preparing for War comes out January, what's the date? 3rd? January 3rd, 2023. So maybe you're listening to this before that, maybe you're listening to it after. So if it's before, definitely go and scope it out for pre-order. If it's afterwards, go and find it anywhere you possibly can. It's fabulous. I'm loving it. And I'm wondering if you can just tell people where they can find you if they want to follow along with everything you do in the future.
Yeah. So I'll just give one plug for pre-order. So there's a book called The Case for Christian Nationalism. Okay. And this book is basically laying out a white ethno-nationalist argument for in Christian nationalist terms. So it uses the words of Aquinas and Calvin, but it basically says that if you're a white American, you should love people like you more than others. And that comes from God. That comes from God. That book is like, depending on what day you look, like in the top 1,000 on Amazon. And if you know anything about Amazon, there's like 20 million books on there. So if you're in the top 1,000, you're like in the top 0.01%. All that to say, that's what we're up against. So if you order a book like mine or any other on Christian nationalism, it helps to kind of offset just that enormous tide. So anyway, you can find me at Twitter, Bradley Onishi. You can find my show at Straight White JC. We publish 3 times a week. And so we're always just, we got new content all the time, and various folks coming on the show to talk about these issues. And that's the best place. You can go to bradonishi.com as well and find all my info.
Amazing. Dr. Bradley Onishi, thank you so much for joining me to talk about your new book, Preparing for War. It's been a real pleasure, and I have loved this conversation. Even when it's been challenging for me, I have really enjoyed our time together today.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.